Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean to learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi, a PhD candidate at Princeton University. And today with me is a special guest, Professor Xavier Lufin, who is a professor of Arabic literature at the Free University of Brussels. He has translated several novels, short stories, poems, and dramas from Arabic into French. And among his recent publications is in English. I've translated the title. The book is in French, The Black Poets of Arabia, Poète Noir du Arabie, an anthology published by Édition de l'Université de Bruxelles in 2021. And today we will be discussing his book, Another Look at Congolese History, Arabic and Swahili Documents in the Belgian Archives between 1880 to 1899, published by Académie Royale des Sciences d'Outre-mer in 2020. And it's part of a series, Sources of African History, which is an international publication project initiated in 1962 under the general auspices of the Union Académique Internationale in Brussels to publish critical editions of sources for the history of sub-Saharan Africa. Welcome, Xavier, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your book.
I thank you for the invitation. Thank you.
You're welcome. So another look at Congolese history unlocks an unprecedented journey through the tapestry of Congo's past in Central Africa and the Indian Ocean world. This meticulously compiled collection unveils a trove of Arabic and Swahili archival documents nestled within Belgian archives, presenting an unparalleled lens into a transformative era. Spanning the eve of Belgian colonization, these documents illuminate the diverse cultural landscape, revealing the profound influences of Arab Muslim communities on Congo's societal fabric. From the Arab campaign to the expulsion of Azande sultans, these texts narrate the entwined destinies of communities, their interactions, and the seismic shifts in power dynamics. Today, we will explore the evolution of Arabic script in East and Central Africa and its appropriation by local populations and the intricate dance between Arabic and Swahili as potent tools during a tumultuous period of colonization. The book traces these invaluable historical records, colonial acquisition, and geographical origins, offering a vivid mosaic of voices across vast regions, from letters to contracts and acts of submission to manuscripts, notebooks, and amulets. Each document paints a vivid portrait of historical events, intertwined with linguistic nuances and epistolary formulas. We will learn more about these complexities of scribes, translators, and the materiality shaping the preservation of these texts, revealing the depth of the cultural interplay between the Congo and the Indian Ocean world. But first, before delving into the book, we would like to learn about its editor. So please, if you can, share a few words about yourself. That is, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in Congolese history and its transregional connections, and if you would like to mention any mentors and book that shaped your career along the way.
Okay, so I was born in Brussels, the capital of Belgium, and that's where I grew up. I grew up in a place called the Skerbeek, which is quite a kind of a multicultural area, with a lot of people with different origins. That's why I went to school. And in the late 80s of the past century, I started my studies at the Free University of Brussels. That's the university where I teach now. And I studied archaeology at university. And while studying archaeology, I discovered that there was a department of Oriental languages in the same university. And it's strange because I started to learn Arabic by chance. My main goal was Turkish. I was really interested in learning Turkish, not specifically Arabic, but in the Department of Oriental Languages at that time, and it is still the same today, actually, Arabic was compulsory. So if you wanted to learn Turkish, you had to learn Arabic as a first language and then Turkish as a minor. And so I said, yes, why not? It must be interesting too to learn Arabic. But as I said, my goal was Turkish. And at the end of the day, I became specialized in Arabic language and Arabic literature. And what is the link with Africa in all those studies? I had some family connections with Congo because my father was a pilot, and he used to travel quite often to Congo, and so Congo was a name which was very familiar to me. And actually, it's the same for most Belgians, because most of us we had a relative who had a connection through one way or another with Congo, and so. I was also I've always been very interested in the history of Africa in general and Congo in particular. And I started to after I finished my MA in Oriental languages, I discovered that in many travelogues written by Belgians or Europeans who traveled to Congo in the late 19th centuries, they were quite often mentioning Arabic as, well, it was not really clear, but some of them were mentioning documents written in Arabic, or the fact that there were some Muslim traders and things like this. And so I thought, well, maybe that the documents they mention in those travelogues still exist. Maybe I can find some traces of those documents, and that's the way I started to dig more and more in the history of Congo. So you asked me whether I have mentors. Yes, I could name so many people, but I will just mention some of them. First, let's say, during the colonial period, there are two authors that I find particularly interesting. The first one is Trimingham, who wrote a series of books about Islam in Africa and Sufism in Africa. And for me, it's an important name because he gave some consistency to the studies of Islam in Africa during the colonial period. I mean, Islam was not just a name or just a word, but he really tried to expose. He was not the only one, of course, but he really tried to dig into the Islamic culture of Africa in a very interesting way. And the other name is more related to Belgium. It is Armand Abel. Actually, Armand Abel was a Belgian Orientalist, and he was teaching Arabic in my university. So I never met him. I think he died before I was born. But he wrote a very interesting book in 1959, which is just 1 year before the independence of Congo, which is called Les Musulmans Noirs du Maniema, so the Black Muslims of Maniema in eastern Congo. And it is the first time that somebody who knows very well the Arabic culture and the Islamic cultures writes about the Islamic culture in Congo. So for me, it was really a pivotal book, very, very, very important book. And then, of course, I should mention after the independence, for a more recent period, the tremendous work made by John Hunwick and Rex O'Fahey. You know, they wrote together this collection of this series of books called Arabic Literature in Africa, with one volume dedicated to one specific geographical area of Africa. And well, for me, though, this series of books is really a treasure, and it encouraged me to see whether something could be done about Congo, because of course Congo is absent of this book. And again, a little bit like Trimingham, what interested me in the works of Hunwick and O'Fahey is the fact that for them, Arabic or sorry, Islam or Arabic were not just words, but they really tried to show that there was something to say about Islamic presence and Arabic presence in Africa in terms of culture, and not just in terms of politics or history.
Indeed. Thank you for sharing that journey that really connected you profoundly with the Congo through your life, which is quite, to be honest, quite unique in many ways, because usually Africans who are working on you know, this part of Africa usually don't dabble in, let's say, Middle Eastern languages and assume the lack of literacy and the lack of textual archives in the pre-colonial era for this part of Africa. So for someone to be interested in this region, but also to acquire the needed linguistic skills to, you know, explore such an archive is quite really infrequent to find. So if you can reflect on that, why do you think, or let me rephrase that, is it the problem, is the way we initiate students and departmental training and they provided, you know, resources for that? Or is it a much deeper problem with the discipline of African history that assumes, you know, that pre-colonial African history is by default void of textual archives and literacy?
Yeah, I would definitely take the second option that you mentioned. I'm really surprised even today. I mean, how people who work in, for instance, in Congo, in parts of the country where there are Muslim communities, when I ask them whether they have seen documents in Arabic or whether they do know something about anything related to Arabic literacy in Congo, they say, "Oh no, I've never seen anything of that kind in the, when I was in Congo." Even sometimes with the people working working with Muslim informants in Congo. And the way I explain it, of course, there are many reasons, not only one reason, but I think that if I had to summarize the main points, I think that most of the people who are interested in the history and in the cultures of Africa, especially for sub-Saharan Africa, they consider that Africa means orality or oral traditions, you know? And so they focus on this. They think they do not expect to find some written documents that would be earlier than, I mean, the colonial prisons, just because they are not trying to hide it, but they are just not expecting this, because in their way, in their vision, Africa really means oral tradition, which is not completely false, of course, because if you take Congo, of course, the main means of historical transmission remains oral tradition, but still it's not the only one, and this may explain the invisibility of literacy, let's say Arabic and Ajami literacy in Congo. Then there is another explanation, I think. Of course, there are people who are interested in Arabic studies, or Islamic studies, or both of them. But they consider that country like Congo is peripheral. I mean, it stands at the periphery of the Islamic and Arab world in at least two dimensions. First, geographically, it's a remote area, far from what they are, I mean, used to deal with. And then also, Islam or Arabic culture reached the area in a quite late period, which is the second part of the 19th century. So to summarize, I think that people who are interested in African studies are not interested in or are not aware of Arabic literacy. And the people who work on Arabic literacy, they are not interested in studying countries like Congo or Burundi or Rwanda or other parts of East Africa, because they, and so it's more lack of knowledge than kind of I mean, it's not that people are avoiding to study those areas, but they, yeah, there is a lack of connections. It's like we have two worlds, you know, people specialized in Arabic studies, Arabic and Islamic studies, and people who are specialized in African studies, and they don't meet or they don't share the information, which is not the case for West Africa, of course, but for, let's say that for Central Africa, it strikes me to see this situation.
Indeed.
Not only in Europe, actually, but even in Africa itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite right, and which makes scholarship such as yours the more valuable to spread awareness about the existence of these literary traditions in Central Africa. Which leads me to ask you about the idea of the book. How did it develop, and what motivated you to trace, collect, edit, translate, and contextualize the documents that you published in this volume?
Yeah. So, as I said earlier, the first clues that I met was, as I said, when I was reading those 19th century travelogues. Let me take the example of Richard Burton when he explored the hinterland of East Africa. He mentions the fact that he leaves Zanzibar with the with letters, and that he brings these letters to Arab and Swahili merchants who dwell in the hinterland. And so because Richard Burton was also interested in Arabic culture, so again, we come back to the same problem. He mentions, the existence of literacy in the East African hinterland. He's not talking about Congo, more about Tanzania and countries like this, but still he mentions this. And that was the first thing that made me think, well, if there are some Swahili and Arab traders in Congo, they should have the same relationship with literacy. If Burton brings letters to Muslim merchants established in Tanzania, why would the same merchants established in Congo be illiterate? It's a nonsense. So I guess that those people too, through one way or another, had connections with literacy. And so I started to read books written this time by Belgian officers or administrators who worked in Eastern Congo mainly during the late 19th century. And they did exactly what Richard Burton did. It means that they mention in their travelogues or in their official reports the presence of literacy. In of course, they were not specifically describing it, but it was a detail in the reports. They were mentioning that, for instance, they met a merchant who had a copy of the Quran at home, or they describe a local chief who has who uses Quranic verses as a talisman. And then some others mention merchants exchanging letters. And so when I saw this first in the travelogues, I thought I should check in the archives, and maybe that by chance we could find some documents related to I mean some letters written by merchants or things like this. And so I started with this clue found in those travelogues. And actually I went first to the main museum related to Africa in Belgium, which is the Tervuren Museum. It is now called the Africa Museum, and it is located in Tervuren, which is a small city outside of Brussels. This museum was built by King Leopold II, and in order to emphasize the colonization, the importance of the colonization of Congo at that time. And so I went into the archives and I checked, especially in the archives related to officers, Belgian officers who worked in Eastern Congo. And I was struck to discover actually some documents written with the Arabic scripts. And then I started to open other files and new files, and I discovered that, well, there was a quantity of documents that was sufficient to do something about it. So I first published some articles in French and then in English about some specific documents related to one Belgian officer or to one specific area of Congo. But then I went to other museums and other archives, like the what we call in French les archives africaines, so the African archives, which is the name of all the archives dating back to the colonial period, and which are now in the ministry, at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And there I discovered some new documents. Then I went to the Royal Palace, and I discovered that even there were some documents. And so when I saw all those documents, I thought, well, nobody talks about them, so I should try to show them, and to show them to the historians, to the people who are interested in the history of Congo, because until now, most, if not all, the books related to the history of Congo are always they always rely on information written by Europeans, or they rely on oral tradition, but again recorded by Belgians. But they never use, I mean, documents like those Arabic and Swahili letters and treaties and so on. And so that was really the aim of my book. I realized that I had enough of documents. I have found something like a little bit less than 100 documents in Arabic and in Ajami Swahili. And I thought, well, I mean, I would like the historians to use those documents, to know them, to see that. I will give you an example. There is a famous character of the Congolese history. His name is Ngongo Lutete. He's very famous, actually has been executed by the Belgian authorities, colonial authorities, but he was an important chief, an African chief, who worked first with the Arabs and then with the Belgians. And he's still considered as a hero in Congo. Well, I have found some documents written in Arabic mentioning his name, mentioning a battle between Ngongo Lutete and Arabs. And I said, well, there is no information at all regarding this this specific event in the books related to the history of Congo. Or, I mean, when you find something about this battle, it is always based on European sources. Here we have something new. So it's just an example, but many of those documents, they can shed a new light on the history of Congo, I think. And so that's how I decided to make this book. So I proposed them a transliteration I mean, I transliterate them. No, sorry, I write down the original text in Arabic script, and then I propose a translation in French of every document that I have found in the archives. Since then, I have discovered, or some colleagues discovered, some few new documents, which means that the work is not over, that they are still, I mean, we still have to dig in other kinds of archives, and for sure we can find some more documents related to the history of Congo.
I was going to ask you about that actually, but yeah, it's amazing to find out that there is more to uncover in these different collections. And it's amazing when we start reading these travelogues and then we find, you know, their evidence in these documents and collections. So it's a beautiful connection to be made between the archives and the travel accounts that we read from the 19th century. But before giving more details about these documents, I would like the listeners to have an idea of how did the use of Arabic writing and Swahili Ajami evolve within the local Congolese population? Were there instances of appropriation or adaptation of the script while being written in the Congo?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because actually myself, I was surprised. You know, when you look at the history of West Africa, that's what happened. You know, Muslim merchants arrive in West Africa. They were exchanging their document, some documents, and then the local population, step by step, started to participate in the production of such documents, because they converted to Islam, and then they learn Arabic, and then they apply Arabic script to their own languages, you know, like Hausa, Fulani, and Wolof, and so on. I thought, well, in Central Africa, the process was shorter, because, I mean, the Muslim communities or the Muslim merchants started to visit Congo probably around 1860, not earlier. So I thought maybe it's this period is too short to see such a phenomenon that we could compare with what happened in West Africa. But actually, it happened. We have different cases. The most interesting one is located in the northeastern part of Congo, in an area called Uele, which is close to the Central African Republic and Sudan today. And then there is a population called Azande. They still dwell in the same area today. And those Azande chiefs, they had some quite well organized kingdoms in the area, and they were in contact with the Arab traders coming this time not from the Swahili coast, but from the north, from Sudan. And it seems that they saw that Arab traders who were visiting their kingdoms were exchanging letters in Arabic, and it gave them a kind of asset, you know. It was something that they hadn't, because they could exchange information, written information, which means secret information, and also they could register things, record things, and so on. And so what the Azande chiefs did is that they some of them learned Arabic. Actually, it seems that most of the Azande chiefs were able to talk in Arabic. But then, coming to literacy, first they hired some secretaries coming from Chad and Sudan, areas like Darfur. Those were Sudanese who were, I mean, they were like, they are called Fuqaha. They came to I mean, to as teachers in Islamic in Muslim schools and everything. But then they started to write letters for the sultans. So we know that we have Azande sultans who were dictating letters. So it's interesting, because first they were sending those letters to Arab merchants, which is quite normal. But I have found some letters that have been written by a Zande chief to another Zande chief, which means that really they appropriated somehow, I mean, Arabic literacy. Even if they didn't write the letters, I mean, directly, they were hiring secretaries, but that's not important. The important thing is that they were using Arabic literacy as a means of communication. And then when the Belgian officers came to the region, they also exchanged letters in Arabic with the Belgian officers. So that's really, I mean, the best case of appropriation of Arabic writing in the area. But there are some other cases, even if we don't have those documents anymore, they are mentioned again by other sources. One good example is Msiri. So Msiri was a king in what is now Katanga. He was quite powerful, and we have a European, his name is Arnaud, who stayed for 2 years in the palace of the king in Msiri, and he describes the king dictating again a letter to a local, to a Swahili or an Arab secretary. It is not clear, but again, it seems that the king was using the presence of Muslim merchants and asking them to write letters to some other people. We have a third example. There is a letter mentioning Ngongolo Tete, so the African I was mentioning earlier. And actually, it's Tipo Tip himself, so the famous merchant who was in Eastern Congo. In one of his letters, he says, the letters is written in Arabic, and is sent to the King Leopold, and he says clearly in the letter that he has sent a letter to Ngongolo Tete in order to inform him that the Belgians were in need of manpower in the area. And so he was asking Ngongolo Tete to find some workers for the Belgians. But the interesting thing is the sentence in the letter. He says, I have sent a letter to Ngongolo Tete. So again, it doesn't mean that Ngongolo Tete was able to read Arabic, but maybe that, like the Azande chiefs or like Msiri, maybe that he had a secretary who was able to read the letter and then to translate it to Ngongolo Tete and probably to answer the letter in Arabic. I say in Arabic, actually, those documents are sometimes written in Arabic and sometimes in Ajami Swahili. Of course, the European observers, when the letters are missing and that we have just the testimony of the Europeans, it is never clear whether the letter is written in Arabic or in Ajami Swahili. But still, it's the same, I would say, the same literacy.
Fascinating. So how would you describe the Arabs or Omani Swahili presence and its influence on the cultural and social fabric of the Congo on the brink of the Belgian colonization, especially in relation to the use of Arabic writing or Ajami writing?
So their influence was quite important in many ways. As I said in the beginning, for a long time, literacy seemed to be invisible in the European testimonies. However, the European observers often highlight other kinds of influence on the local society. For instance, they quite often mention that new tree species and plant species were introduced in the area. You know, like lemon trees and some specific crops, you know, were brought from the Swahili coast or even from Oman into East Africa. Then there were other influences like clothing. It seems that many people, even people who did not convert to Islam, adopted, you know, like the kanzu and other specific clothes related to Muslim and Swahili culture. Also, the way some houses were built in some areas, all those things were heavily influenced by the Omani and Swahili presence in the area. But the most striking influence is, of course, the language. Not mentioning literacy, Swahili very quickly became a lingua franca in the area. And we have depictions of, some kings, even in some remote areas of Congo, were either able to talk in Swahili, or they were using Swahili interpreters who were, translating from their native African language to Swahili, and then from Swahili to probably English or French. And that's at the end of the 19th century. So it's a multi-layered, influence on clothing, on, food, buildings, and of course, language. And so inside the linguistic area, there is this importance of literacy, which, and then of course, I didn't mention the religious factor. Quite quickly, because we are mentioning Muslims coming from Oman and East Africa, but quite quickly, the local population or a part of the local population also converted to Islam, because Islam was related to all those goods that were brought in Eastern Congo and to a certain level of life that attracted the local population. If I take again the example of the Azande Sultans, if we take the descriptions that we find in the travelogues and the different reports written by Europeans in the late 19th century, most of them adopted the clothing of the Arabs coming from Sudan. As I said, they were able to speak Arabic quite fluently, but also many of them converted to Islam, especially the chiefs, not the whole population, but some of the chiefs were Muslims. For instance, we have a depiction of Sultan Zemio, the son of Tikima. He's the author of some of the documents written in Arabic. And so he kept his Zande name, which is Zemio. But according to the depictions made by the Belgian officers who were in northern Congo at that time, he was behaving like a Muslim, like he was... He always had a copy of the Quran in his hands. When he was about to sign a treaty with the Europeans, he brought the Quran with him. He also had some Quranic amulets in his garments and everything. So yeah, that's the whole influence of the Omani and Swahili and Sudanese presence in Congo.
Yes, and so we learned that during the last, let's say, three decades of the 19th century, the Arab traders coming from Zanzibar and overall the Swahili coast been trading ivory and enslaved humans, among other things, with the Congo, and eventually they interact and confront the advance of Europeans, the Belgian in this case, in Central Africa, and the relationship fluctuates between cooperation and open hostility. So can you please introduce the Arab campaign and the subsequent expulsion of Azande Sultans, as you've highlighted? And how did these events impact the dynamics and interactions among these documents that were generated as a result of these many conflicts?
Yeah, again, and that's very relevant. All the documents that I have found until now in the archives date back to the to the 80s and the 90s of the 19th century, not later. And it shows somehow it says something about the evolution of the relationship between the Arab and Swahili traders and the Europeans. At the beginning, the relations were quite, again, if I have to summarize, they were quite positive. It seems that Europeans were, I mean, first of all, they were happy to see people who, how to say, you know, in the racist way of seeing the African society at that time. I mean, the Arabs, because they were Muslims, because they had literacy, because they were monotheists, were, I mean, better considered than the rest of the African population. So that's the first thing, and it's quite obvious, you know. Even people, when they some of the observers at that time, even when they criticized the Arab or Muslim challengers in the area, they somehow respect them because of all those elements, and they thought that we cannot say that there was a kind of state in a Muslim state in Eastern Congo. You know, merchants were there just to make trade. Of course, they had some settlements, but it was not supposed to be, I mean, an official part of a larger Muslim territory. So first, the Belgians thought that they could integrate, or that they could keep those Arab merchants, and that they could even sometimes rely on them in order to establish themselves in the area. And on the other side, it seems that the Arab and Swahili traders saw the Europeans as people passing by. I mean, they were not going to settle down in the area. Then in the beginning of the, let's say, the years 1890s, the Arab and the Swahilis understood that the Belgians were there to, that they were intending to stay in the area, and that they were really, I mean, colonizing the area. I mean, they were bringing their flags. They were, I mean, building, like, not really cities, but, you know, more and more settlements. And on the other side, the Europeans, they also understood that those merchants who settled down there were going to stay as well. And so there was a kind of rivalry that was actually there from the beginning. But in the 90s of the 19th century, it really, I mean, both sides understood that, I mean, somebody had to win, that they would be just one ruler in the area. And so that's how the war started. And it lasted from 1892 to 1894. In 1894, most of the Muslim settlements were, destroyed by the Belgians. And that's really a changing point in the history. You know, that as I said, most of the documents written in Arabic date back to before this period or during this period. Later, we don't have documents anymore, because there was a kind of, the Belgians decided not to chase away the Muslim communities, but they tried to restrain them, to keep them at the same size, and forbidding new Muslims coming from Tanzania or other part of Africa, forbidding the introduction of books or anything that would be written in Arabic. And so there is this big difference. At the very beginning, I mean, the Belgians were even, I mean, they were receiving letters from their Arab counterparts or Swahili counterparts, and they were also answering to them in Arabic. So that's quite amazing. During the 80s and the 90s of the 19th century, the Belgian officers had secretaries coming from the Middle East, who were translating the letters written in Arabic to the officers, and who were also writing down their answers into Arabic. So it means that at an early stage, the Belgians were using Arabic as a means of communication with the Muslim traders. But then after the Arab campaign, all those things stopped. And I mean, Muslims were, let's say, subdued. And so Arabic was not seen as a means of communication anymore. So if people wanted to communicate with the Europeans, they had to learn French or to communicate through Swahili, which was adopted as a lingua franca as well. And so I really see a change in the use of literacy after that period. But it doesn't mean that literacy disappeared. Actually, it never disappeared. I was in Kisangani in September, and I saw that in Kisangani, for instance, some people are still reading books in Arabic, using Arabic in their, mainly in their religious life. But something changed at the end of the 19th century, for sure.
Right. And in addition to the Swahili, Omani, let's say, current coming from the Indian Ocean, from the Nile Valley as well, you have the Ottoman, Egyptian, Sudanese connection advancing towards the south. And we have writings that are in the, let's say, Sudanic or Sudanese traditions. So how would you describe that current coming from the north rather than the east? And mm-hmm. did it ever intersect with the Swahili traditions, or were they always separate?
So it's strange because the both ways of penetration into Congo started somehow around the same period, which is 1860. So around 1860, Swahili and Omanis were reaching eastern Congo, and at the same time, Sudanese and Egyptians, as you said, arrived in the northern part of Congo. It seems that at the very beginning, they were not really aware of each other's presence. But then around, let's say around maybe 1880, something like this, a little bit later, they knew of of each other's presence, and they started to connect. And the Belgians interfere, of course. They were fearing that a connection between Muslims coming from the north and from the east would reinforce the Islamic presence in Congo, and would weaken the European presence. So it developed so at the same period, but differently. Because as I said, in the eastern part of Congo, literacy was in Arabic and in Hajami Swahili, while in the northern part of Congo, at the beginning, literacy was only in Arabic. And an interesting thing is the linguistic feature of the letters that survived until now, because they are written in a kind of Middle Arabic, which is quite close to the colloquial Sudanese Arabic. So the letter is not written in classical Arabic, but more in a language which is, somewhere between classical Arabic and Sudanese colloquial Arabic. So that's a first first difference between the two languages, I would say, or the two linguistic situations in the same country. But then there is something else. Later in the 1890s, we have very few surviving books, but we have surviving books in both Eastern and Northern Congo. The books that we have found coming from Eastern Congo are, of course, related to the book tradition of the Swahili world. And so when you look at the titles, It's somehow the titles that you can find at the same period in Tanzania and in Kenya and so on. While in the northern part of the country, we have in our archives, for instance, two copies of a book which is called Ratib, which is a collection of prayers written by El Mahdi. Of course, this book was not circulating in eastern Congo, but it was specific to northern Congo.
And El Mahdi, of course, Mahdi to the listeners.
Yeah. So Mahdi was the main a Sudanese chief who opposed the British in Sudan in the late 19th century, so he was exhorting people in Sudan to revolt against the British, and actually it led to an uprising against them and to the famous battle of Omdurman, so he was both we could say he was a political as well as a religious leader, his influence was very strong in Sudan, of course, but even in the northern part of Congo, because when the Mahdist troops were defeated, some of the Mahdists went to the south, and some of them arrived in northern Congo, and that's how we have found those books, like the copies of the Ratib. Then there is a third way, which is not well explored, but which is very interesting, and it's a contradiction in the colonial history. You know, I said that the Belgians were trying to break the influence of the Muslim communities in eastern Congo and in northern Congo, but at the same time, they were hiring people from West Africa, and many of them were Muslims. And they were hiring them as manpower, you know, when they started, so that's at the beginning of the 20th century, when the Belgians wanted to build a railway from Matadi to what is now Kinshasa. They needed manpower, and local manpower was not enough. So they brought people from Mali and Senegal. Most of them, of course, were Muslims. And that led to the building of the first mosque of Kinshasa I should check, but I think that it was something around 1908 or 1910, which is very early. And even before them, you know, during the initial process of colonization of Congo, because Belgium was a very small country, Belgium was hiring soldiers from different parts of the world. Some of them came from Zanzibar, but many of them were Hausa from West Africa. And of course, those Hausa were Muslims as well. And so it's quite funny to see that the colonial power somehow started to break the influence of Islam in some parts of the country. But then unconsciously, they also brought a new Muslim population in the country, because those people still live in Congo now. If you go to Kinshasa, if you go to Kisangani, you will find some West African Muslims. Sometimes they have their own mosque, you know, and they are there since the very beginning of colonization. So it's a third way of a third way of penetration, which still has to be explored, you know, because I guess that to give you an example, the Muslims in eastern Congo are Shafi'i, but the mosque that was built for the West Africans in Kinshasa was a Maliki mosque, you know. So I guess that if you somebody should make an inquiry about the books that are used among the West African Muslims in Congo. I'm sure it would bring some very interesting information regarding them, regarding their own literacy and their own tradition You know, I didn't mention, I had no time to mention titles of books, but books are circulating in Congo since the late, books in Arabic are circulating in Congo since the late 19th century. And it should be interesting to compare what do West African Muslims read and what do, let's say, Shafi'i Muslims read in Congo. But that's another chapter.
Indeed, sounds like an amazing project. And hopefully our mutual friend Faisal Al-Hassan is listening, among others, who would be interested to trace these connections between the Sahel to the Swahil, I guess. There's so much history to talk about that these documents uncover. But unfortunately, we have a limited amount of time. Given this hour, we've covered a lot of history that I hope the listeners will find it motivating to go and explore more and read these documents. And if you know Arabic and Swahili, I'm pretty sure you will be amazed by these documents and what they have to tell you. And if you're not, I encourage you to consider it as a source for learning more about the history of Central Africa during this period. One more aspect that I would like to ask you about these documents, about the challenges you encountered while compiling this collection. And if there were aspects you wish to include but couldn't due to the nature of the project. And I say this because many scholars noted that the Belgian archives, in comparison to other European archives on Africa, happens to be the least explored and studied. Things are changing now, of course, but if you reflect on that in connection to the challenges you encountered while working on this collection.
Yeah, to be honest, most, if not all, the people working in the different archives that I visited were very open. So at the contrary, sometimes they were even curious, you know, because they had those documents in Arabic, but they didn't know what they were talking about. And so they were even encouraging me in, I had no problem, for instance, copying or photocopying or scanning the documents or get access to any kind of documents. People were really very open, even at the Royal Palace, you know. At the beginning, I had some difficulties to see the documents, but it was just because they were, renewing the library, and I had to wait for a while because the documents were displaced, you know. But otherwise, I must say that I really didn't encounter any problem in getting access to the documents and copying them and everything. At the contrary, yeah.
In addition to with working with these documents, if you would like to mention any challenges you faced.
Well, the main challenge I would say is a linguistic one. As I said, the documents coming from northern Congo are mainly written in colloquial Sudanese Arabic. Actually, I work on Sudan since a long period, so I don't have any difficulty, reading those documents. But I would say that the Swahili documents are sometimes quite uneasy to read. And that's why I have a new PhD student. He comes from Tanzania. His name is Shaibu Champunga. He started his PhD with me just last month. And he will work on the, he will take, all the documents in Swahili that I have translated, because there are some lacks. I know that there are some errors in my translation. He will propose a new translation of the documents. And also, he will try to identify the dialectal variety of those documents, because I have the impression that most of the documents are written in Kiunguja, but I'm well, he's a native speaker, so he will be able to cope in a better manner with those documents. Another challenge still with the Hajami Swahili is that there is no standard orthography of Swahili, which means that sometimes every scribe, every writer has his own way to write Swahili with the Arabic scripts. And so it makes it quite uneasy to read. And so some documents are, I mean, really deserve more attention by specialists who will focus on the language and propose a better translation than the translations that I made. That's the main challenge. I would say that the other challenge that I started to tackle in September is to go to Congo and check there whether there are still other documents to be discovered. And actually, they are. When I was in Kisangani, I stayed just for 2 weeks in Kisangani, and I have found some very interesting documents. Those documents are not very old, but still they are very interesting because there is something very, very strange. I mentioned at the very beginning of the interview the name of Armand Abel, who made this fascinating book, who wrote this fascinating book about the Black Muslims of Maniema. So the book was published in 1959. And after that, almost nothing is said regarding Arabic or Ajami literacy in Congo. It doesn't mean that it stopped. It just means that, well, people didn't write about it, or I mean, there was a kind of invisibility of the phenomenon. And so we have this gap between 1959 and today, which is more than 70 years. What happened during those 70 years? So I went to Kisangani, and I plan to go in a couple of months to other places like Kasongo and Nyangwe to see whether some documents still exist and to talk about, I mean, local population to see, to get more information about the history of Arabic and Ajami literacy in the country. And that's the main challenge. What happened after the independence? I mean, you have almost no information. With very few exceptions, you have one or two very short articles mentioning, I mean, a prayer book coming from Congo, and but those are short and isolated articles. There is no, I mean, a thorough study of the phenomenon, and so that's a real problem. You know, to give you an example, I asked people when I was in Kisangani, do you still write Swahili in? Do you still write Ajami Swahili? And they told me, no, my grandfathers used to do it, but we don't do it anymore. And so the question is, okay, when did people stop writing Ajami Swahili? And it was quite uneasy to find, you know, a date. But then by chance, in a small mosque in Kisangani, in the local archives, I have found a letter written by a local imam in Ajami Swahili. And the letter was written in 1979. But so for me, it was amazing. That was, I mean, 20 years after the last study made in Congo, and you could still find documents written in Ajami Swahili. But well, I have found two letters. Shall we find something else later or earlier so that we could have a larger corpus? It's the whole point. I mean, what is the situation in Congo now in terms of literacy? That's the real challenge.
This sounds like another maybe linguistic anthropology project that someone should pick up. So as the listeners have noted, the book really intersects with the work of historians, linguists, anthropologists, and other scholars who are interested in Central Africa and the Congo. So the collection in this book promises to provide new narratives maybe asking the same old questions, but answering them differently in the light of different sources, but also contributing to the study of linguistic history in the region as well, as we've noted. We've taken a lot of your time, and I'm really appreciative of sharing this fascinating history. But before letting you go, we would like to learn about your current and future projects. We just a disclaimer, we've met recently during a conference that you've organized along with Jihan Safar in Brussels on slavery and post-slavery in the Arabian Peninsula. So if you can share with the listeners some of your activities and projects to keep an eye on what's going on.
Yeah. So now I have two main challenges. I mean, I'm now working on a book in English this time. The title would sound like Arabic and Ajami Swahili Literacy in Congo, an Invisible Heritage, something like this. And the idea is this time not to translate the documents that I find, but to write the history of literacy in of Arabic and Ajami Swahili literacy in Congo, and to show the difference. You know, I mentioned books, I mentioned letters, but there are, I mean, I have dozens of titles. Of books that circulated in Congo or still circulate in Congo, and every book has its own history. Then we have other kinds of documents, like very interesting weapons, you know, like throwing knives coming from northern Congo. And on those throwing knives, you find Arabic or pseudo-Arabic inscriptions. We know that there were some carved doors, carved wooden doors with the Arabic inscriptions in. So I will try to summarize the whole thing of what is literacy about in Congo in this book. And my other challenge is to widen the network. So as I said, I have now a Tanzanian a PhD student who started to work with me. I am trying to get another PhD student from Congo this time, who will also work on those documents. And my project is really, I mean, through new funds to extend the interest of the scholars regarding Arabic and Swahili literacy in Congo from the colonial period until now. And I really hope to encourage new and young researchers in working in this field.
And hopefully this podcast will contribute to raising awareness about the state of the field and your contributions to the study of Congolese history in the wider Indian Ocean world and African history. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. And thank you for the listeners for tuning in which we explored Xavier Lufin's book, Another Look at Congolese History, Arabic and Swahili documents in the Belgian archives between 1880 to 1899. This is your host, Ahmed El-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.